It's Tuesday, March 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Myanmar's parliament selects a new president. North Korea's leader calls for more nuclear and ballistic tests following an apparently failed test earlier this year.
One has to assume that Kim Jong-un was likely embarrassed and figured he had to do another nuclear weapon test in order to prove he really could have something that was like an H-bomb.
And we look at how the music industry has been rocked by recent sexual assault charges. It's all ahead. Myanmar's parliament has voted to elect Tin Jaw, a close associate of National League for Democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi, as the country's next president. I'm joined now by VOA Southeast Asia correspondent Steve Herman, who is in Naypyidaw, which is the capital of Myanmar. So, Steve, what was this like? Was this a sort of dramatic event when this took place today?
Well, it was definitely historic. I don't know about dramatic as far as the selection of the president, because it was very obvious that the NLD had the votes to elect Tin Jaw. And in fact, he took 360 out of the 652 votes cast in a joint meeting of the legislature. But where there was drama was about the selection of who would be the first vice president. The NLD had put up an obscure Chin Christian, Henry Van Thieu, but he was soundly defeated by the military's candidate, who is quite an unpopular retired general who's a Yangon regional chief minister. So he will become the first vice president.
Is it known how these two will they work together?
Well, that is quite the question, because Aung San Suu Kyi has said she'll be above the president. So she'll be presumably calling the shots in the executive branch. But the retired lieutenant general, Minh Sui, is quite unpopular. Although everyone we talked to today from the NLD and the Union Solidarity and Development Party, which will become the opposition party, and the one military brigadier general who's an appointed member of parliament, one member of the military agreed to speak with us today, although he wouldn't even give us his name. They all said, look, we got to work together. This is about reconciliation. So at least today, there are very optimistic and kind words being said.
And I believe a U.S. State Department official commented on the proceedings.
Well, this is a comment very similar to what we've been hearing for some time now from the State Department, and that is that they remain concerned about the Constitution as it is right now, which the State Department says, quote, contradicts fundamental democratic principles and prevents the people of Burma from voting for the leaders of their choice. And that is a reference to this clause that the military put in some years ago, which was seen as specifically barring Aung San Suu Kyi from becoming president, because it says that anyone whose spouse or children have foreign citizenship cannot become president. And her two sons do have British citizenship.
All right. Thanks very much, Steve. That's VOA Southeast Asia correspondent Steve Herman reporting from Naypyidaw. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky with a look at what's trending. So, Andrew, what's happening?
Well, beware the Ides of March.
Oh, yeah.
Today is March 15th, also known as the Ides of March, famous because that was the day when Roman leader Julius Caesar was stabbed by Brutus in 44 BC, of course, dramatized in Shakespeare's play Julius Caesar. So lots of people talking about that on social media. Lots of jokes going around, Shakespeare quotes, those kind of things. I liked, somebody said, I'm going to dig into a Caesar salad today at lunch with my friends. We're all going to dig in. Other people saying, I hope your friends are better than Julius Caesar's, and hopefully you get through the day without incident. So as we see a lot of times on social media, when there are these kind of events, historical events or otherwise, a lot of reaction to that. And of course, people connecting it to today's Super Tuesday contest, another big trending topic. People saying it might be a day to beware for some of the candidates who may not fare very well in the Super Tuesday contest, but a lot of attention being paid to that as we go through the day, as those contests get underway in states like Florida, Ohio, North Carolina, some very big states in the presidential nominating process.
Absolutely.
We also have trending today, Mother Teresa. She the Pope has announced, Pope Francis has announced, she will be named a saint on September 4th. Now, he made an announcement last year in December saying that she would be named a saint, but didn't say when. So now he said it'll be September 4th. So a lot of people online celebrating that, wondering if there's going to be a big mass in St. Peter's Square at the Vatican, a canonization mass, if people can attend that. People already wanting to go to that, even though it's months away. People sharing a lot of quotes from Mother Teresa as well. The one I liked that I saw, it said, "If you judge people, you have no time to love them." So a lot of nice sentiments like that. But also people detracting, some opponents of either the church or Mother Teresa, saying that she took money from corrupt organizations. So even on social media, even Mother Teresa can face critics.
Everyone can be controversial.
Everybody can be controversial. Everybody has critics.
Thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
The first of the two ExoMars missions took off for the Red Planet from the Baikonur Cosmodrome on March 14. ExoMars is a joint project between the European Space Agency and the Russian Federal Space Agency, Roscosmos. The EXO in its name stands for exobiology, a branch of science that examines the possibility of life on other planets or in space. The purpose of ExoMars is to find out if life ever existed on Mars. The two spacecraft now being sent to Mars are the Trace Gas Orbiter and its attached Schiaparelli EDM lander. Once they arrive at the Red Planet sometime in October, the lander will be sent from the orbiter to the surface. The lander will monitor various weather conditions on Mars. The orbiter will circle Mars and will sniff out the sources of methane and other gases in the Martian atmosphere. Methane has been seen as a possible sign of life since the gas is produced here on Earth by living organisms. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the music industry is rocked with charges of sexism. The Russian Defense Ministry Tuesday said it has begun withdrawing some of its military equipment sent to Syria. On Monday, President Vladimir Putin surprisingly announced a partial withdrawal from the country nearly 5 months after it began an air campaign in support of the Bashar al-Assad regime in Damascus. Speaking during a televised meeting with his foreign and defense ministers, Mr. Putin said he believes the goals set out by the Russian armed forces in Syria has in large part been fulfilled. And that is, in his words, the fundamental turnaround in the fight against international terrorism. The White House says President Obama discussed the matter with his Russian counterpart by phone. White House spokesman Josh Earnest Monday said Moscow's military presence has hindered a political settlement to the five-year conflict.
We have talked about how Russia's continued military intervention to prop up the Assad regime made the efforts to reach a political transition or to make a political transition even more difficult, that as long as Russia was aggressively weighing in militarily, they were removing at least part of the incentive for the regime to even engage in those kinds of conversations. So I haven't seen the reports, so it's hard for me to assess at this point what sort of impact this will have on the talks, what kind of change this will bring about to that dynamic. So we'll have to see exactly what Russia's intentions are.
Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal tells International Edition's Victor Beatty that while he was surprised Russia made the announcement sooner than he expected, the two sides have achieved their objectives of propping up the Assad regime and weakening the opposition.
At the same time, remember, the Russians were having a very hard time sustaining this expenditure for two reasons. First of all, their own military does not have as many of these aircraft that they've been using as one would have assumed and expected. And their maintenance was very, very expensive. The cost of this whole operation was very high at a time when their earnings were dropping like mad. And they also knew at the same time that the Saudis would rather borrow but keep the oil prices down in order to hurt both Russia and Iran. And they seem to be succeeding in that strategy there at this moment. Now, what the Russians are trying to do is basically to say, look, we have achieved our primary objective. The peace process could very well begin, although that's a bloody sham, and I don't think much is going to happen on that front. But they have created a situation where Assad government is clearly more powerful, and they could very easily go for eliminating all the opposition they may have in places closer to the Turkish border. And under those circumstances, it could be a situation where they may, in fact, be in a much stronger position than one assumes in this United Nations-based negotiations which began today.
Western diplomats are speculating that Mr. Putin may be trying to press President Assad into accepting a political settlement to end the war.
Not necessarily. Remember, once you build up a government as strongly as they have done, there is no reason for them to back away from it. Remember, they are not going to completely abandon Assad. The specter of their intervention remains. Even though they may gradually start to withdraw some of their forces, they will clearly like to recoup their air force, which has a limited stock of these very sophisticated weapons that they've been using. But at the same time, this fear that they can come back in is very much there. The point really boils down to is they have a horse in the game. And that is Assad. We don't have any horse. So we have a problem. They don't. They can always come back. For them, there is a very clear-cut target, very clear-cut objective, which they're after. And even though they withdraw right now temporarily, they're not going to disappear from the scene.
Zubair Iqbal of the Middle East Institute describes the Russian move as a tactical withdrawal. He says Moscow's surrogates from Iran and Lebanon's Hezbollah fighters will remain in Syria, along with Russian weapons and equipment. As for the peace process, Iqbal calls it a sham that will achieve only a respite for both sides to resupply and prepare for the next phase of the conflict. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un said Tuesday the country will conduct a nuclear warhead test and conduct a series of ballistic missile launches despite tightened UN sanctions against such activities. Mr. Kim made the announcement, carried on state-controlled media, following what was described as a successful simulated atmospheric missile reentry test. Bruce Bennett is a Korea analyst with the RAND Corporation. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the announcement is an anticipated follow-up to what's widely described as a failed nuclear test conducted in January.
Because it was buried about twice as deep as the third nuclear test, it was probably designed to be about 50 kilotons, and it came only out at only 10. And as the worldwide reaction among experts that said it wasn't really an H-bomb started to filter into North Korea, one has to assume that Kim Jong-un was likely embarrassed and figured he had to do another nuclear weapon test in order to prove he really could have something that was like an H-bomb.
Well, what do you make of this announcement about ballistic missiles and nuclear warheads?
He's clearly trying to push himself to the point of actually having demonstrable nuclear force. He wants to be declared a nuclear power. He's so far been basically a nuclear experimenter. He hasn't demonstrated any forces. But if he has the reentry vehicles required, the warheads required, and they work, and he can demonstrate that, then regardless of what the U.S. government says, there will be fairly broad international recognition that North Korea is a state with operational nuclear weapons.
So what will the outside world do? Monitor this closely, and how will they determine the effectiveness?
If there's a nuclear weapon test like there was back in January, we'll be able to get a pretty accurate read on the size of the explosion, the so-called nuclear yield. If that is, again, around 10 kilotons, roughly the size of the Hiroshima explosion, it's not really looking like an H-bomb. If it's up in the 50 or 100 kiloton range, that's a whole different story. It is in the direction he's suggesting. That would be a big development, a big increase in the threat. Similarly, if he tests a reentry vehicle, thus far, every missile he's been testing of the long-range missiles has been for, quote-unquote, satellite purposes. If he's actually going to test an ICBM, he actually has to test it as something delivering a warhead. If he does that, he is so seriously in UN Security Council resolution violations, the world is going to have to clamp down on him, and even China, who has been reluctant to make things really bad, is going to have to take more serious action.
Bruce Bennett of the RAND Corporation says with Tuesday's announced successful simulation, the North is trying to perfect the technology needed to protect the warhead on a missile so it can survive the fiery re-entry phase from space. South Korea says it has not detected the kind of activity expected prior to a nuclear test or rocket launch. Tuesday, President Park Geun-hye warned Pyongyang it is headed towards self-destruction if it continues on its confrontational path. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Representatives of American record producer Dr. Luke have denied that Sony Music will end its relationship with him due to allegations that he sexually assaulted pop rocker Keisha. International Edition's David Byrd and VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee talked about how Keisha's case has highlighted the issue of sexism in the music business.
She alleges that he was psychologically abusive, and then the lawsuit, she also claimed that he drugged and raped her. And this has been going on now for over a year. Recently, and this was probably in the last few weeks or so, Keisha was in court. She was asking to be released from her contract from Kemosabe Records, which is Dr. Luke's label on Sony. But the judge denied the preliminary injunction. So she was not allowed to be released from her contract. But Sony said, you can work, but just not with Dr. Luke. She has six more albums that she's required to complete for Kemosabe and also for Sony. And as a result of this, quite a few very powerful women in the industry have come out.
Including people like Kelly Clarkson.
Right, have come out in support of her. Taylor Swift, I think, gave her $250,000 for her legal fees. Lady Gaga has come out publicly in support of her. Adele has come out publicly in support of her. And Kelly Clarkson, who was interviewed in Australia, said, hey, he's not a very nice guy. I had to work with him. I didn't want to, but Sony insisted. In fact, they blackmailed me. Those were her words. So there are some reports now that Sony plans to end their relationship with Dr. Luke ahead of their the expiration date of the contract, which will be sometime next year. Now, Sony has not confirmed nor denied this, but these are the reports, and people are speculating that this is probably because this has become a PR nightmare for the label, for Sony.
And Sony doesn't like bad PR. I mean, it's like, we want everything to stay stable. We want everybody to be happy, and mm-hmm. let's all get along. Because
right.
in the end, Sony is not in business to make artists happy, even though making the artist happy is important.
Yeah.
Sony is in business to sell CDs or downloads or vinyl records or whatever format you choose to consume their music on. And anything that interrupts that process, it's just like the Takata airbag thing with Honda.
Mm.
Honda had to call back a whole bunch of cars because there was something wrong with the cars, and they don't want their brand being associated with something bad. Am I right in that?
You're absolutely right, and that's exactly what's happened. I mean, this is a huge story, not only in the pop music world, but folks who are inside the music industry are watching this very closely, because this is one of the first times where we've actually seen the inner workings of the industry. There are other artists who have come out, not against Dr. Luke, but other female artists who have come out to say, you know, this is kind of par for the course. And so Kesha has become sort of a shero for many of the women in the industry. Now, I think it's very important, however, to say that Dr. Luke denies all of the allegations. And Sony, a representative for Sony, came out to say, we have no evidence that what Kesha is alleging is actually true. So right now, it really is he said, she said.
Okay, well, that's where we'll have to leave it for right now. If you have any comments on this, you can send Shauna a tweet. She's at VOA Lady DJ. You can also hit her up at VOA underscore music. And you can look for her show, The Soul Lounge, on our website, voanews.com.
And that's our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The illegal trafficking of endangered wildlife has escalated to alarming levels. In 2015, poachers killed 1,175 rhinos just in South Africa, compared to 13 in 2007. Annually, around 30,000 elephants were killed for their ivory tusks to make a profit. As a result of poaching and trafficking, many iconic endangered species are on the verge of extinction. But there is much more at stake here, said Assistant Secretary for International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs William Brownfield. These crimes are not committed by small-time poachers, but by well-equipped, well-organized global criminal networks, and they are aided by a web of corrupt and criminal facilitators. These are organized, efficient, often violent, and well-funded networks. They are responsible for fueling not only the depletion of natural resources, but also undermining the rule of law, causing permanent harm to communities, local economies, and to the environment, fomenting instability, and providing a significant source of funds used by violent cartels, gangs, and even terrorists. In response to this escalation in 2013, President Barack Obama established the Presidential Task Force on Wildlife Trafficking, co-chaired by the Departments of State, Interior, and Justice, to coordinate a whole-of-government approach to stop illegal activities that threaten the future survival of many species of wildlife. This and other efforts by the United States and its partners around the globe have caused a turning point in the fight against wildlife trafficking. For example, the State Department has partnered with the NGO African Wildlife Foundation to build regional law enforcement cooperation in Eastern Africa, develop a canine program in key ports in Africa, and elevate the issue of illegal online trade of wildlife. Implementation is underway. Through this partnership with AWF on a canine detection program, two dogs at Jomo Kenyatta International Airport have been deployed for routine baggage checks. It is evident that passengers are aware of their presence, and that in itself sends a very strong message to traffickers. Just in January 2016, four seizures were made at this airport. The entire world has a stake in protecting the world's iconic animals, said President Barack Obama, and the United States is strongly committed to meeting its obligation to help preserve the Earth's natural beauty for future generations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.